Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Of the news. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. Coming up this half hour, a story that was supposed to be about a golf putter and the fake science behind its design turned into something so much more after the scientist at the center of it all committed suicide. A departure from the expected. The most popular item in the New York Times website in 2013 wasn't a story, photo, or video based on original reporting. It was a quiz built by an intern. And Richard Sherman's rant at the end of the NFC Championship game on Sunday night, the beginning of the Super Bowl media hype, I'll ask our panelists. I've got a lot more I hope we can get to today as well, but let's start with a St. Louis story that's not all that different than one Mike and Ernest talked about this program a few weeks ago. You remember the reporter in Fargo who got into hot water for sneaking into a school with a hidden camera to test security procedures? Well, the investigative unit at KSDK did something similar. It sent a staffer into four schools just to see what would happen. According to reporter Lisa Zygmunt, everything went as planned during the first three stops. And then they got to Kirkwood High School.
Our photographer knew to go straight to the office, but the office wasn't close. He walked past dozens of classrooms, the cafeteria, even staff, without being questioned. After more than 3 minutes in the building, he asked a teacher where to find the office. That teacher didn't question him either, but instead pointed him down the hall. Once inside the office, our photographer identified himself by name, saying he wanted to talk to someone in security. The secretary called, but no one answered. So our photographer left his name and KSDK work cell phone number. Before leaving, he asked to go to the restroom. He wanted to see if anyone would escort him. Again, he was pointed in the direction and left on his own. He never went to the bathroom. He exited the building exactly where he entered.
An hour after the KSDK staffer left school property, the school was put on lockdown, alarming many in the community and resulting in some pretty heavy criticism of the station's tactics. Now, the three of us have spent a lot of time talking about this off-air. Let's bring the discussion out here for our listeners, too.
Well, the real shame is that there is a story to be told about the different standards the different school districts have and how quickly they are willing or able, because of resources, to take care of some of these security situations, you know, post shootings in Connecticut. But all of that got lost. The story was about KSDK, and they blew it big time. And there's lots of ways we can say that they blew it. But first of all, I mean, you can argue about whether the hidden camera technique was justified or not. Let's say for a moment you grant them that one. Everything else after that was wrong. They didn't have an exit strategy for when they went into the office and they go to call the security person. Everything from there just went wrong.
Yeah, from a standpoint of, and we talked about this in the Fargo story, I don't understand what the impetus is to do these kinds of stories. I mean, you could have easily talked about security or lack of security in schools in another way besides sending in a reporter to see how far they can go, what access they're going to get, and that sort of thing. Because it can set off some triggers, which it did in this case. And now there are bad relations between the news station, KSDK, and the school district. And, you know, that doesn't help the community. It hurts us as journalists.
But, I mean, the question for me is, after they went in, they made the decision to do it, having seen what had happened in Fargo, you know, they did it. but they didn't have a plan for what came next. Once they got into the office, once it was determined that the security officer was not immediately available, that's the time when you say, well, I am a reporter with KSDK. We're doing this story. We'd like to talk to your officials because we want to get more details about what security precautions you are taking or hope to take in the future. If they'd done that, they probably would have been okay, but they really compounded it because the guy left. And in the tape, he said, well, instead of going to the bathroom, he left, walked out the door. That's what set off the alarms in the school, because the school personnel in the office saw that he didn't go to the bathroom. Where is this guy?
Yeah, they saw him go the other
That's
way.
That's when they call for security. That's where they wonder if there's somebody walking around here who's dangerous. They get his, they call his cell phone number and they get a recording that says he's a reporter with KSDK. How do they know that?
And then what even made it worse was that once they called, they got that message, they called the station, and they didn't get a call back from the station for another 10 to 15 minutes. That set off a whole bunch of other red flags, which ultimately led to the school being locked down. I mean, it's just one of those things where, as you said, Mike, there should have been a strategy in place as to how we're going to identify ourselves as news reporters covering a story once we get to the point where that becomes something that needs to be done.
So Mike had said one of the issues was in how the person who was in the school identified himself. Do you see this all turning out differently if instead of writing down first name, last name, and the cell phone number, which is a KSDK paid for cell phone number, if at that point he had actually taken out a business card that identified himself as being with KSDK at that point, could that have changed the whole situation in just that one instance?
Well, I think so, and I think he's ethically obligated to do that. That's one of the tenets of journalism is that, you know, if you're going to identify yourself with a name and a phone number, you should also identify that what station you're working for, what newspaper you're working for, what media organization you're working for.
Not only did the reporter make an ethical mistake, but when he gets back to the station, and we're only speculating. We don't know whatever happened, and they're probably never going to tell us exactly what happened. But when he gets back to the station and the school is calling saying, was that your employee? We're about to go into lockdown. They would not give a candid answer to that question. Well, why wouldn't you give a candid answer to the question? Most of us are supposing, lacking any answer from the station, that this was going to be a sweeps piece that was going to run during February when they highly promote series, trying to garner numbers and ratings that can drive more advertising revenue. And they just hadn't figured out how they wanted to respond. So instead of telling the truth, they left the district hanging while they're talking to their lawyers or their executives or whatever, figuring out what their response is going to be.
And it winds up not being a sweep story because they become the story and then they have to report that with a what I think is a pretty lame apology, saying basically coming out saying we were doing this as a service to the community. We want to try to protect our children and show that there are discrepancies and there are lapses within the security at school. Well, if that was the goal of your story, you missed that because all of a sudden you became the story.
So this may be kind of a hard question to pose to you guys on the spot, but you had said, Mike, school safety is a very important issue that we need to be looking at as journalists. How do we do that in a more responsible way to tell that story that doesn't seem so cookie cutter?
Well, part of the problem, and as some of the ethicists have written about this, have said, is the story, as far as we know, was not looking for solutions. It was looking for sensational ways to demonstrate the problem. It's okay to showcase the problem, but you ought to be talking about solutions. We'll never know if they intended to do that, because, as Ernest said, they had to run something to cover their butts before they were finished with the reporting process. But that's what they should have done, problem and potential solutions.
And I also think that, I mean, going along with that is that you could have had, they had one person on who was a security expert, and he did have some credentials, he did have some knowledge, but they also should have had someone from the school district. They had a spokeswoman from the school district, but I think if there had been more cooperation with the school districts about what they're doing, what they're trying to do, what's the difference between a high school and an elementary school, which they went to three elementary schools, which and they showed that there was some good security at those elementary schools. But when you're talking about a high school, that's totally different.
And especially this high school, given its size, you know, they had mentioned that it's so large, it's multiple buildings on the campus, 37 entrances. If students on an open campus situation are having to walk from one building to another, you can't have doors locked if students are to make it to class on time.
This story is very complex. And the way in which they put it together, they took all the complexity out of it and made it seem like this simple story that you could just walk into a school. And it's anything but simple.
And it all blew up in their faces. Right. Well, our next topic is about a story that ran last week on the ESPN offshoot site, Grantland. Dr. V's magical putter first went up on the site last Wednesday. Feature reporter Caleb Hannon spent 7 months working on the piece, which looked at the validity of the science supposedly behind the golf club's design. Through his reporting, Hannon found the science to be invalid, and the deeper he dug, S.A. Ann Vanderbilt, Dr. V, stopped cooperating. We think that's because Hannon discovered that Dr. V, a woman, had been born male and outed her to a major investor. In October, about 5 weeks before the story was originally set to run, Dr. V killed herself, and editors at Grantland decided to have Hannon rework the story to include parts about Dr. V's being transgender and suicide. Last Friday, 2 days after the story was published, talk surrounding it went from being about faulty science behind the putter to the egregious act of outing Dr. V, and starting a real discussion about how media covers the transgender community. Having read the story and the subsequent criticism of it, is Dr. V's transgender or suicide germane to any of the reporting or the story as it's published?
Well, I think it's germane to the story, but I go even further back to talk about what was the decision, what went into the decision to decide to run a story after the suicide. Was it the fact that you spent so much time on it? Was it the fact that there was some faulty science there? Or was it the fact that you had all these complex issues going on that warranted a story that needed to come out? I think that there should have been a lot more talking in this story. There definitely should have been a lot more vetting, and there should have been a discussion with members of that community to actually say, wait a minute, what are we doing here? And are we being effective in the way in which we're doing the story?
In many ways, it's just a truly sad story. And no matter how, you know, Grantland decided to, whether they ran the story or not, somebody took their own life. And I do think that one thing that's different about this story from the one we just talked about is the fact that Grantland was incredibly open about the entire process. I mean, you can tell it from just reading the story, first of all the things the reporter himself went through. Then you have the editor talking about why they felt they made a mistake, and not just some sort of generic, you know, corporate apology like KSDK made, but in detail, I mean, an earnest apology for what we don't know about the transgender community, how we should have vetted this story at different points with them before making a decision. I'm not sure they decided improperly to run it. I mean, I think after everything that happened, maybe it was a moral obligation for them to run the story and tell all of this, you know, sort of sordid, you know, detail about why they didn't know as much as they should have known about the transgender community. But at least they have been open and above board about every aspect of this story going forward.
And what's happened after the story's ran and the backlash has come has sort of opened the eyes of Grantland and other news organizations about the lack of diversity. And when we talk about diversity, we tend to talk about it in terms of ethnicity. But you need to think about it across the board, not just ethnicity, but also sexual orientation, gender, all across the board. And when you don't have that diversity within your news organization and you don't seek it out or recognize that you don't have it, you run into issues like this and you find out after the fact. And when you should have been able to deal with this. I mean, we're talking 2013, but we still have these issues come up over and over and over again.
I mean, for example, one very specific one came out that experts in the transgender communities pointed out that, did your reporter know that oftentimes there's a much higher percentage of fact of transgendered individuals who commit suicide when something like this happens? Now, does that mean you don't run the story because the person might kill themselves? I don't know. You've got to determine on the merits of the story, but you ought to have that information going into the decision-making process. And now I hope a lot more of us will.
And in their explanation, in Grantland's explanation of how they went about this story, they actually talked about, you know, we didn't use the correct language in our story. We didn't frame this the way that it should have been framed. And had we had sought out members of the transgender community within the journalism community, we would have done a better job of explaining in the way in which we use the words, in the way in which we frame the story, what was actually taking place here.
Okay. Well, President Obama announced Friday that he will place some new limits on intelligence agencies' bulk collection of phone call records. Mike, sum it up for us. What are some of these changes we're going to be seeing?
Oh, boy, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I mean, basically, there are a lot of non-changes, is the best way to put it. I mean, in some sense, the president says he's investigating, for example, having a panel of folks who are available to argue against when the FISA court is trying to decide whether or not to allow sort of surreptitious monitoring, suggesting that they might, that the federal government might take those phone records and metadata out of the hands of the NSA and give them either to the phone companies or some third party. But I think the takeaway for most people was the president used his speech as an opportunity to describe why a lot of changes might not occur because of his belief that we still need those the ability to do the kind of surveillance that the NSA is doing to keep us safe.
I go back, and we've been talking about this for several months, ever since the Eric Snowden since Eric Snowden released all the material. And I keep coming back to the fact that you hear a lot about this within the journalism community, within the political community, within the First Amendment community. But I'm not hearing a whole lot about it in the overall community. They know that it's out there. They have a sense of it. But I hear more people talking about the fact that Target was infiltrated, and their credit cards and their credit card numbers and all their information has basically been stolen. They're more concerned about what's happening in that realm than they are about what's happening with Eric Snowden.
Well, and nobody knows that better right now than Mike C. The suburban Chicago man lost his daughter last year in a car crash, and somehow retailer Office Max got a hold of that information.
It says, Mike Say, daughter killed in car crash, or current business, and this is my home. Why would they have that kind of information? Why would they need that? What purpose does it serve anybody to know that? And how much more information, if they have that, do they have on me or anyone else? How do they use it, and what do they use it for?
There you go. It's,
you know, this goes directly to what I'm talking about. You know, people trust the government with their information. Mm-hmm. They don't trust corporations with their information. And because of situations like this that come up, I mean, people are really concerned about what's happening with Target, what's happening with Neiman Marcus, you know, who has access to my credit information.
How Office Max finds out your daughter was killed in a car crash
and puts it on a mailing. I mean, that's just incredible.
The mailing, I'm sure, was a mistake. But what I would guess probably happened is that some third party is scooping up all this data, and that Office Max is one of their clients. And I mean, there's no reason why Office Max, the products they sell, would need to know that this man's daughter died in a car crash. But that data got scooped up, and there might be some merchants, for good or for ill, who would want to have that. Once that data gets into your system, it's very easy with all the automated processes we have now for trying to gather audience and gather sales that mistake happened.
I mean, to me, it goes back to what you just said, Mike, the third party. I mean, you provide your information because you want a service. And you may click on the box that says you want your information to stay with this company, but that
you don't have any control, over
that actually happening, and it goes to a third party. I mean, it's that I think people are more concerned about that than they are about what's happening in terms of the government and the NSA.
And any discrete piece of information that a company has on you may be harmless, but when it's all aggregated,
exactly,
and then you can tie all that information together. I mean, I could imagine, for example, that the highway patrol might want to, you know, have a record about the parents of a deceased person in a car accident. There might be other folks that have a legitimate use for that data. But when these third parties aggregate it all together, that's when bad things in terms of your privacy can occur.
And they turn around and they sell it to someone else. Yeah. So, you know, it's becoming a real problem that I don't think our government officials and definitely corporations don't have a handle on. They just don't.
Okay. Quick, first thing that comes to mind, soda or pop?
Soda.
I used to say it pop when I was a kid. I call it soda now.
Okay. Next question. Did either of you take the dialect quiz on the New York Times website last month?
I did.
I started taking it and I got distracted.
It wasn't that long.
By the way, when I took it, I'm closest to a bunch of people in Kansas City who have the same dialect.
Okay,
as me.
Well, and I'll tell you my results in a minute, but let's fill our listeners in on what we're talking about. There was a news application that went up on the New York Times website on December 21st, and in just 11 days, it became the most viewed item on the entire New York Times website in all of 2013. Users answered a relatively short series of questions about how you talk, and at the end, you're shown which parts of the country most closely match your dialect patterns. In my case, I got two different suburban areas in Chicago and Chicago itself. Having lived there for more than 30 years, no shock there either. But what is it about this one item that made it so appealing to users on the New York Times' website?
I tell you, one of the things that I found appealing about it was the very thing that they were criticized for in some quarters. They didn't write up some huge narrative explaining the significance and having a bunch of experts tell me whether it was good or bad that I associated with this dialect or the other. It was just a simple thing that I could try myself and draw whatever conclusions, serious or not, from it. I enjoyed doing it, and it was a learning experience for me. I think sometimes journalists ought to do this kind of data-driven work where they let the audience make up their own mind about how they want to interpret it.
And I think this kind of reporting is what can draw people into newspapers, mm-hmm. into websites, because they can give comments. This provides really what I think is really good informational comments, as opposed to people just blowing off steam about whatever issue happens to be out there.
And if you think there's any question about how engaging it was, a lot of people, including me, went back three or four times to take it because there were technical glitches on the server end.
And I wonder, too, it's something that, you know, the New York Times and the Atlantic, that also posted something about this, they haven't been so transparent about, is I wonder, is they're looking at the popularity of it, how many of those page views are being counted because of people like you who maybe went to the site three or four or seven or 10 times trying to get it to work out of curiosity.
Let's say the page views were inflated. Look what that says about the loyalty to that site and the engagement with that content if people would go back three or four times instead of just saying, heck with it, move on to the next article.
You know, and I agree with Mike on this in terms of the page views. I mean, if you can get people pulled in with something like that, they're likely to look at something else. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it was definitely a win for the New York Times in that area.
And I'll also be the first to say, you know, my Facebook friend list tends to be very high with journalists, with journalism students, with other people within our industry, educators. But this is also something that went viral through social media and was passed from person to person to person.
And in fact, I mean, even though I have the New York Times app and I look at it several times a day, I was directed to it from friends on Facebook.
There was also a 5-minute segment on the Today Show on the day that Bryant Gumbel and Jane Pauley were on with Matt Lauer. So it got exposure in non-traditional ways.
Okay, well, you've guilted me. I'm going to go back and do it for a time.
Now, there's one other point I want to bring up about this is journalism educators. It's interesting to me that this was built by an intern, somebody who was there on a temporary basis, who wasn't a full-time member of their staff. What does that say, too, about, you know, bringing new blood into an organization?
Well,
like
to
this?
Me, it's just one of those things where, you know, he was probably having conversations with someone and it came up and he said, hey, what about putting these questions down and let's see what happens. And someone in the newsroom said, hey, this might work, and put it up on the website. It may just be that simple. And sometimes it doesn't require a whole bunch of thought or big meetings and this sort of thing for an idea to spring up and it actually works.
The kind of planning I think it takes is for a news organization to commit to that kind of innovation and to bring in people who and then be willing to listen to them. I mean, I think you're right. I don't think it was a big plan behind this, but the New York Times does have a plan for trying to encourage innovation. And that's something that every newsroom could learn something from.
We should also mention they hired the intern full time. I want to do a real quick hit on a couple of legal stories, all updates about things we've talked about on the show in the past. Let's start with the Supreme Court agreeing to hear the Aereo case. Mike, what do we know about that?
Well, I mean, the technology basically allows for this company to get around the laws preventing you from being able to watch over-the-air broadcast content without the permission of the broadcaster. They have lots and lots of little antennas that capture the signal locally and then make that content available to people to be able to watch online. And of course, it's terrible for the broadcasters, right? Because they're losing revenue, they're losing eyeballs. But it's unclear whether the courts are going to ultimately say, well, if from a technical standpoint, they're not violating the law, here's an opportunity for people to be able to get their video content in ways that give them more control.
It's going to be really interesting to see how this conservative court is going to look at that. Are they going to go on the side of Aereo? Are they going to go on the side of the broadcasters, mm-hmm. who have a legacy of winning in these types of cases?
Okay, net neutrality was struck down last week. What does that mean exactly, with the exception of maybe higher prices for services like Netflix?
Well, I mean, it may mean higher prices. I mean, it's just one of those things where if people are going to buy these things and the companies are going to have it out there and they're going to sell it, they're going to get as much money as they can out of it.
It's ultimately going to have to be decided by the highest courts, because we've had different rulings so far on whether or not the legacy companies have to allow essentially any content to be distributed over their commercial lines and access to the internet. So net neutrality experts proponents would say that we have to treat those pipelines like a utility, that even though the Verizons and others of the world have invested billions of dollars in that they shouldn't be able to control or favor their own content. Of course, if you put the investment into that, all of that infrastructure, you would think you should be able to favor your own content or regulate the amount of bandwidth that's used to access the content.
But then we go back to the whole Ma Bell situation that we had way back in the day, as they would say.
Okay, well, the Super Bowl is less than 2 weeks away, and the Broncos and Seahawks will battle it out Sunday, February 2nd in East Rutherford, New Jersey. In what was perhaps the first step in the build-up to the big game, fans watching the NFC Championship saw this during post-game interviews.
The final play, take me through it.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a star receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
About you.
Crabtree, don't you open your mouth about the best. Or I'm going to shut it for you real quick. L.O.B.
All right, and Joe, back over to you.
That's Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman, and just moments before he'd made the game-winning play that put his team over the San Francisco 49ers. What is it that got people talking about that so much? That was like the biggest thing come Monday.
Well, I happened to be watching it, and as soon as he did it, I went, uh-oh. You know, here we go, because that starts the Super Bowl hype. I mean, I think it's one of those things where you have a sideline reporter, and they do it after every game. Mm-hmm. You have a sideline reporter go up and talk to the person that they feel made the biggest play or did the biggest thing, and you don't know what's going to happen. Usually they say something that's, you know, profound or going to Disney World or something like that.
The best team won. The team that played four quarters.
Exactly.
Then you move on.
But Richard does what Richard does. I mean, Richard Sherman has a reputation for doing these things. And he did it. He opened it up. They've been talking about it for, what, 3-4 days now on every sports show. It's hype. It's hype.
He's also sly as a fox. I mean, there was some stereotyping. Here's a dumb football player who's going off.
People calling
he
the
planned
thug.
Everything. He was maybe that first initial reaction was just in the moment. Everything after that, where he continued the rant in a little lighter tone, was planned. He was looking in the camera. He knew exactly what he was going to say. He was a graduate of Stanford. This guy knows what he was doing.
He has a persona, and he was basically following his persona.
Okay, well, that music means our time together is coming to an end. I'd like to thank you for listening and watching. You want to learn more about the topics we talked about today? Check out the Links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there. Or send us an email. Our address is views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers runs the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when Mike, Ernest, and I will be back with another edition of Views of the News.